on the record. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is a continuation of the hearing in docket number 1305184, commonly known as the Rocky Mountain Power General Rate Case. And we left off yesterday with, I believe, having concluded the office's presentation, and we're now ready to hear from the division. Are there any preliminary matters before Mr. Jetter presents the division's case? And let me remind all that the public witness hearing will be in this room tonight at 5 p.m. I don't believe we have anybody participating on the telephone today. Is that correct as of today or as of this moment? Okay. Thank you. Mr. Jetter.
Thank you. The division would like to call our first witness, Dr. Artie Powell.
Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Dr. Powell, would you please state your name and occupation for the record?
My name is Artie Powell, A-R-T-I-E. I'm the energy section manager within the Division of Public Utilities.
Thank you. And have you prepared and filed on behalf of the division direct rebuttal and surrebuttal testimony in this docket?
Yes.
And if you were asked the same questions contained within the pre-filed direct rebuttal and surrebuttal testimony, would your answers remain the same?
Yes, they would.
Thank you. With that, the division would like to move to enter the rebuttal and surrebuttal that I believe the direct testimony has already been received by the commission. And so at this time, we'd like to move to admit the other two pre-filed testimony and the attending exhibits.
Any objections? They're received.
Thank you. Have you prepared a brief statement?
Yes, very brief. Good morning. It's a lot cooler today than it was yesterday, so that's nice.
We hope that will be consistent throughout the day.
Well, it's probably going to heat up for me in a minute. The division is generally supportive and has expressed its support for the company's net metering charge and argues that it is consistent with several general rate-making principles, including cost causation. We recommend that the commission adopt a net metering charge in this particular docket, although we differ from the company in the amount of that particular charge. The company revised its recommendation up to $4.65 as part of its case from the original $4.25. The division still supports implementing the net metering charge at the $4.25 per month. In the division's view, the net metering charge is about cost recovery of existing distribution costs, and the division believes that there's sufficient evidence on the record for the commission to implement that charge. While the division believes that there is this adequate evidence on the record, we do not oppose if the commission decides to further study cost benefits under SB 208 in a separate docket, as some of the intervening parties have recommended. Such a study will help the commission on several questions about a net metering program that we outlined in our testimony. Whether or not a net metering program is in the public interest, how that net metering program should be structured, and at what rate the net metering customer should be compensated. And I think I'll leave my summary statement at that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Powell is available for cross-examination.
Thank you. Mr. Moskin.
No questions.
The office has no questions for Dr. Powell.
Mr. Rossetti.
Thank you. I expected it to come quick that time. Just a couple of very brief questions, if you don't mind, and good morning to you.
Good morning.
I hope it stays cool myself, especially when I'm there later today. Would you please define, well, looking at your pre-filed rebuttal testimony of June 26th on line 20, would you please define zone of reasonableness?
I think I'm going to defer that question to the division's consultant, because I'm simply quoting what he concluded in his testimony there, so I'll let him define what that means specifically.
I'll ask him.
Okay.
Thank you.
You bet.
And then the second question is helping me understand cost causation, and this is not... this is from your summary just now. Please let me reflect that back to you and see if I've got it correct. Because a net metering customer creates excess, they get a credit. Later in the day, they redeem that credit by pulling energy out of the grid. But they don't pay the fixed costs associated with that because it was a credit. And that is what we're referring to as the cost causation, and the fundamental underlying principle behind cost shifting. Maybe I should have broken that down into smaller, but so it's the redeeming of the credit later, which does not actually cover the fixed costs. Is that a correct understanding?
In terms of the definition of cost causation, no, that's not the way I would have defined it. Cost causation generally is the principle that if you can identify those who are causing the cost to be incurred, then you recover those costs from those customers.
Okay.
In my mind, it's a fairly simple concept.
Okay. I'm just trying to get my head around it because,
right,
you know, I'm not very well versed in anything like this. So the net metering customer, if they were not to redeem that credit, then they would not be shifting any cost.
They don't redeem the credit. So a net metering customer, let me see if I understand what you're asking me.
Okay.
A net metering customer produces excess energy. They produce more than they consume, and then they're not allowed to use that credit at some time in the future. And therefore they don't cover those costs?
Let's say that they choose not to redeem that credit. At that point, they have not caused any cost to be incurred because they have not used the grid. Is that a correct assumption?
No, I would disagree with that. They use the grid when they pull the electricity off the grid, their production, and therefore they reduce their consumption. And since we're collecting those fixed costs through those volumetric rates, and their volumes are less for the month, they don't pay those costs.
Okay.
So it really has nothing to do, at least in the scenario that you presented, with them not redeeming or redeeming that particular credit. Now, I do disagree with the premise of your scenario, because if a customer produces excess electricity at one part of the day, they don't redeem that credit later that day. That's not the way the net metering tariff works. The net metering tariff works on a billing cycle. So at the end of the month, and I know billing cycles don't coincide directly with month, but at the end of the month, there's a netting of what was consumed. That's where the excess energy comes from. That's carried over to some future billing period that then is credited against the customer's account. So you don't produce it, say, at 1 o'clock during the day and then use that credit later that afternoon at 5 o'clock or 7 o'clock,
mm-hmm,
or at midnight.
Okay.
That's not the way the net metering program or the net metering tariff was designed. That would require much more complicated metering to do it that way.
Okay. I think that makes a lot of sense. Yes.
Okay.
It accumulates over the month, and the customer then redeems that credit at the end of the month. Or carries it over.
Carries over. And thank you, because you just said it much more articulately than what I was trying to. So, yes.
Okay. But I'm trying to understand the concept of cost causation.
Right.
And that comes as a result of the customer using kilowatt hours for which they exercise that credit at the end of the month. So sometime, let's assume that during the month they are not carrying anything over. So that credit offsets kilowatt hours consumed during the month. Would you agree with that? If they do not carry over a credit.
Right. I think what you're saying is that a net metering customer system produces during the month, but it just produces less than what they actually consume. So yeah, it's being used as an offset to their current bill. That's correct.
Great. It's good to get a good understanding of this. And because they actually drew electricity from the grid for those kilowatt hours for which they're exchanging credits later in the month, that is the underlying principle for cost causation.
Again, the idea, if they're drawing power off of the system, in other words, if they're using the distribution grid, then they're causing costs.
Great. Thank you.
Yes.
Appreciate your taking the time. Help me understand. No more questions.
Thank you, Mr. Rossetti. Mr. Cully?
Yes. Thank you, Commissioner. Good morning, Dr. Powell.
Good morning.
We haven't had the chance to meet before. My name is Thad Cully. I'm counsel for the Alliance for Solar Choice. So before we get into my questions, which I will keep brief, I just want to walk through a couple of statements made in your testimony, and that'll be the focus of our conversation. So starting, and we're going to jump around here kind of fast, with your direct testimony on page 14, starting with line 277, you state that the division has made no attempt in this period to quantify the cost or benefits.
Hang on.
I'm sorry. I'll wait for you.
Line 277, did you say?
That is correct, sir.
Okay, now my pagination is a little bit different. I'm on page 13. But that may be a difference in...
Redacted.
Okay.
There we go.
Okay.
Okay, so the division has made no attempt in this period to quantify the cost or benefits of the net metering program. Okay, then on jumping to page 3 of your rebuttal testimony, looking at line 35, you state, pardon me, SB 208 requires some cost-benefit analysis. While the company did not provide a comprehensive evaluation of benefits in its direct case, others have and will continue to analyze the benefits. And did I read that correctly?
Well, where was that at again?
I apologize for getting ahead of you. This was line 37 of rebuttal.
In rebuttal, and read that again. What are you reading?
So it was, line 35 to line 37.
Okay. SB 208 requires some cost-benefit analysis.
Right, correct.
Okay, correct.
And then continuing on to line 37, you observe as Mr. Freeniers, if I pronounce that correctly, let me know, indicates in his testimony, parties have not successfully shown that net metering benefits are not reflected in our current rates.
Right.
Okay. Then finally, going to your surrebuttal on page 10. And starting with line 197, so I'll give you a second.
Yeah. All right.
All right. And so there you state, however, no party to this docket has presented persuasive evidence that net metering customers are undercompensated, or if so, what the appropriate compensation is.
Correct.
Okay. And Dr. Powell, is it your understanding that a utility filing a rate case application generally must carry the burden of proof before the commission?
Yes.
Okay. And when you participate in the case, do you generally try to understand the parameters of the case, including the legal parameters?
Generally, no. Not the legal parameters.
But when the legal parameters may affect the outcome of the case, that might be a part of the strategy you work out with the attorneys. Is that correct?
We might discuss that.
Okay. And would you agree that SB 208 was an issue in this case that involves legal parameters?
I think so.
Okay. And did you comment on SB 208 and your understanding of its importance in the Let me restate that. And did you comment on SB 208 in your testimony and your understanding of its importance to the commission's decision in this case?
Important in which way? Specifically, which one of those statements do you think?
I'd say, did you comment in your testimony on whether it's important procedurally and substantively to how the commission resolves this case?
I think what I commented on is that the SB 208 directs the commission that they have to undertake some cost-benefit analysis. I think what our testimony is, or my testimony is, that I articulated in my summary is that there's sufficient evidence on the record to adopt the net metering charge.
Okay. Let's see. And are you familiar with the standard the commission uses for determining what the burden of proof is?
From a legal point of view?
But just, from your understanding in terms of how you prepare a case, how you work on preparing a case?
In a general way, yeah.
Okay. I'd like to introduce a cross-exhibit this time. Okay, and just to be clear, Dr. Powell, I'm not going to ask you to read this whole thing into the record. And the first document in this cross-exhibit, actually before I do that, Commissioner Clark, if I could ask to have this identified, I guess this would be our fourth cross-exhibit.
Right, it's identified as TASC cross-exhibit 4 for identification.
Thank you. So the first part of this cross-exhibit is titled Response of the Division of Public Utilities to the Rocky Mountain Power August 28, 2008 filing, responding to motions to dismiss or to restart the 240-day statutory time period. And that appears in docket number 08-035-38. Do you recall participating in this case?
Vaguely.
Okay. And so if we could just turn to page 7 of these comments, which is also page 7 of the cross-exhibit, I would just ask that you note, whether I'm stating this correctly, that the comments here say that the burden of proof is well established, that the burden, you know, includes providing all necessary information to the commission and allowing it to set just and reasonable rates. And there's a case cited, the Utah Department of Business Regulation Division of Public Utilities versus Public Service Commission. So do you see that?
I see that reference, yes.
Okay. And now if we could turn to the next tab I have.
Was there another question about that? Or I mean, I see the reference. I don't I'm not seeing what you articulated before you referred to it. Is there a question, another question there?
Not related specifically to that. What I wanted to turn to was now the commission's order following the submission of these comments. And that is the next tab, which will be found on page 26 of the cross exhibit, which is on the upper right hand side of the page. And do you see at
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. And you see at the bottom of the page, at least the indented paragraph there.
Just below where it says court has stated?
Yes.
Okay.
And would you mind reading, let's see, I think the first three sentences of that.
Okay. In the regulation of public utilities by governmental authority, a fundamental principle is the burden rests heavily upon a utility to prove it is entitled to rate relief and not upon the commission. The commission staff or any interested party are protestant to prove the contrary. A utility has the burden of proof to demonstrate its proposed increase in rates and charges is just and reasonable.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Powell.
Okay.
And if you flip to the next page, you see that this commission order cites the same case that the division cited in its response, and that is the Utah Department of Business. And just for sake of, okay, thank you. Just to be comprehensive here, I included another attachment, which is that Supreme Court case. And it's another tab. I would just have you look at that tab and see if that look. It's the last paragraph of that page, just to make sure that looks like the standard you're familiar with as well.
Commissioners, I'm going to object to this line of questioning. I think it goes pretty far beyond the directive, Dr. Powell. And I think it's leading down the road to call for a legal conclusion, which is also, I think, an inappropriate direction to go with this line of questioning. I'm not sure what the relevance of having Dr. Powell read from commission's orders that I'm sure the commission's aware of is going to provide.
Mr. Culley?
And this really is the end of this use of this exhibit, and I'm not really asking for an interpretation of the documents, just want to ascertain if what is contained here is consistent with Dr. Powell's understanding of the burden that must be carried by the utilities.
I'm not sure that Dr. Powell's understanding of the burden that must be carried by the parties in a legal sense is something that he can really testify to.
I think the question would be, did he rely on these materials or in the preparation of his testimony in this case?
Mm-hmm.
And if you would like to ask that question, I think you may.
Sure. Thank you, Commissioner. And Dr. Powell, is it fair to say in making comments about whatever the burden of proof is that you relied on your understanding of well-established commission precedent on whether a utility carries the burden of proof?
That's not what I was commenting on in my testimony, no.
Okay. Well, then let me turn to page 10 of your surrebuttal. And this is a quote we went over already, but I think we can restate it here. It's line 179.
179?
I'm sorry, I inverted that. 197.
197, okay.
Okay, so there you say that no party to this docket has presented persuasive evidence that net metering customers are undercompensated. So I'll leave that quote there. And is this in reference to the statement of some witnesses in this case that SB 208 might allow for additional compensation as it allows for charges and credits? charges or credits?
Good. Yes.
Okay. But it is your position that the company carries the burden of proof to justify the NEM facility charge as just and reasonable. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. One last thing. If we could turn to page 4, line 38 of your SIR rebuttal.
Line 38, did you say?
Yes.
Okay.
Line 38 through 40. If you could just read, this is a part of, you've quoted SB 208's pertinent language. If you could just read that quote
for me. Right. Says, determine a just and reasonable charge, credit, or rate-making structure, including new or existing tariffs, in light of the costs and benefits.
Okay.
Emphasis added.
Thank you, Dr. Powell. I have no further questions. Thank you.
Ms. Roberts?
Good morning, Dr. Powell.
Good morning.
Some of my questions are similar to those of Mr. Cully, but there are some differences, so I want to try to perhaps approach these issues from a slightly different way. Looking at page 4 of your rebuttal testimony, you state that SB 208 requires some cost-benefit analysis, correct?
No.
On line 35 of your rebuttal testimony.
On page 3?
Sorry, page 4, line 35.
For some reason, we have different paginations.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So that's why I was questioning. On line 35, it states, SB 208 requires some cost-benefit analysis.
Thank you. That is what I had asked.
I'm hoping that I've got the right copy.
That's
of
what my
testimony.
We're in the same place and reading the same quote, so I think
okay.
We're.
Commissioner Clark, could I ask, is it on page 3?
We have that on page 3 of 4,
okay.
Line 35.
Okay.
In the middle of the page.
We're in the same place.
Great. I have an odd page break in mind. That must be the difference. My apologies. And you agree that SB 208 governs the Commission's consideration of Rocky Mountain Power's request for the net metering charge, correct?
Not necessarily.
Could you explain that, please?
Again, in testimony, what I tried to explain anyway was that the net metering charge is about cost recovery of existing facility costs. What I envision as a cost-benefit analysis of under SB 208 will address questions about how to design a net metering program and at what level of compensation you would compensate net metering customers for. So the costs and benefits under SB 208 are talking about the costs that are imposed or potentially imposed on the system from net metering customers. The costs that I'm talking about in terms of the recovery under the net metering charge are distribution costs that already exist.
SB 208 states that the Commission shall determine whether the costs exceed the benefits for net metering or the reverse, and then it says that based on that determination, the Commission shall establish just and reasonable rates, including a charge, credit, et cetera. Is that a correct paraphrase of the legislation in question?
Correct.
And to you, that does not suggest that before a charge is imposed on net metering, that evaluation of costs and benefits should be completed?
I think it's up to the Commission to determine whether or not the evidence that's on the record satisfies the cost-benefit analysis under 208. In terms of whether or not they can establish a net metering charge. We believe that the testimony that's presented has established that a net metering charge is just and reasonable.
Referring back to page 3 of your rebuttal testimony where we were just reading, you state that the company did not provide a comprehensive evaluation of benefits in its direct case, correct?
Correct.
And as you were stating to Mr. Cawley, the company does bear the burden of proof with respect to fees that it requests as part of its general rate case, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Is it the responsibility of interveners or other parties in the case to provide evidence that's required as part of the company's direct case?
I'm just going to object to the extent that calls for a legal conclusion. Beyond that, I think you can go ahead and answer.
Commissioner, Dr. Powell testifies extensively in his pre-filed testimony regarding the intervener's failure to convince him regarding the benefits and discussing the company's failure to provide a comprehensive evaluation of benefits. And I certainly believe that his testimony makes the kinds of conclusions that Mr. Jetter is characterizing as legal. And so I believe that it's fair to ask him questions on this line.
Dr. Powell, do you have an opinion that's responsive to the question Ms. Roberts asked?
I have an opinion. Whether it's responsive or not, I won't decide. But let me explain it this way. When the company files a rate case, yes, they have the burden of proof to demonstrate that what they're asking for is just and reasonable. My understanding of the legal parameters around a rate case is that if the commission does not act within the 240 days, those rates automatically go into effect. And therefore, when we intervene in a case and offer testimony, contrary to what the company is asking for, then we're trying to prove that what the company is asking for is not reasonable. And I'm applying that same standard to the interveners in this particular case. The company has filed, in my mind, what is sufficient evidence to support the net metering charge, and I don't see any evidence from the other parties in this case that would change my position on that.
Okay. Is there a presumption of reasonableness of the company's case?
Same objection from the division.
Same response to the objection.
Can I jump in here?
I'm going to sustain the objection.
Oh, shoot.
And allow you, Ms. Roberts, to rephrase the question in relation to Dr. Powell's testimony and the views that led him to file the testimony in the form that it is.
Thank you. Now, the page numbers that I have made in my notes appear not to be correct, so I might not be able to point you to this statement quite as precisely, but you stated somewhere that you're not persuaded by the interveners that, maybe Mr. Cawley pointed this to you earlier, that the current rate-making structure does not adequately compensate net metering customers.
Ms. Roberts, I think the line numbers work.
Line numbers work. Well,
they seem to be consistent. So if you provide a line number, I think that will help us all.
That's okay, if they want a line number. I was going to say that's, I think, a fair paraphrasing of what I said.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to move on to a different topic. I'm sorry. Turning now to your surrebuttal testimony, Dr. Powell.
Okay.
And line 22, you state, if, as the division holds, an identifiable subclass of customers, such as the net metering customers, are allowed to shift a portion of their share of the costs to other customers, the resulting rate design will violate the principle of cost causation and therefore will not be just and reasonable. That's the division's position, correct?
Correct.
Is it your view that allowing any identifiable subclass of customers to shift a portion of their share of costs to other customers would violate the principle of cost causation?
Any clause? Yes.
So all customers that consume less than 500 kilowatt hours a month are an identifiable subclass, are they not?
Yes.
So does it follow from the statements that you've just made that you agree that all customers that consume less than 500 kilowatt hours a month should be required to pay an extra fee in order to make the overall scheme just and reasonable?
No.
Could you please explain that answer, because it seems a bit counterintuitive based on your previous responses?
In my direct testimony, I articulated, I think, five or six principles that the division looks at when they go about trying to design. That's the wrong document. Hang on.
Mm-hmm. Yes, these are the Bonbright principles?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And those principles are often contradictory to one another. And so just because you're violating cost causation when you set a rate design, you may be fulfilling other principles that in that instance you think are more important.
Okay, so referring back to your sir rebuttal testimony then on lines 24, beginning on line 24.
Okay.
You state, the resulting rate design will violate the principle of cost causation and therefore will not be just and reasonable. Would you like to make any correction to this testimony?
No.
So it's possible for a rate design to violate the principle of cost causation and still be just and reasonable?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
This statement is in reference to what I'm identifying here. You have a class of customers, subclass in the residential class, that are readily identifiable. In other words, by saying identifiable, what I mean is that you can easily separate them out from the rest of the class. And based on that, the idea would be that in rate design and allocation of costs, one of the first things you do is ask the question, can we identify, at least easily, the customers that are causing these costs, and in a fairly simple way, allocate those costs directly to the customers? And so that's the principle that I'm saying is being satisfied here. The net metering customers can be identified, they can be separated, we can identify the costs that are associated with those customers, and therefore those costs should be directly assigned. To allow those customers to shift those costs or a portion of those costs to another customer or a class of customers violates the principle of cost causation, and that outcome in this case or in this instance would not be just and reasonable.
So, Dr. Powell, when you say an identifiable subclass, you mean a group of people that have distinguished themselves voluntarily rather than simply a group of people that can be identified by the utility?
Well, I'm not sure I would make that distinction between voluntary and just being identified, but all I'm saying here is that net metering customers, by the fact that they're on the net metering tariff, are readily identifiable by the company.
Okay, thank you. On my final topic, on page 4 of your rebuttal testimony, and probably I'm wrong on the page numbering.
Of the
it is line.
Rebuttal testimony?
Yes, back to the rebuttal.
Okay.
This is on line 39. You state, the cost-benefit analysis required by SB 208 should be conducted with an eye toward three important issues. First, whether a net metering program is in the public interest. What does the public interest mean to you?
There are several things that go into the public interest. In general, I would say that the public interest is the general welfare of the customers as a whole. We could get into, excuse me, we could get into subparts of what that means if we need to.
Okay. So the general welfare of those customers might mean something other than simply their relationship with the utility company?
Their relationship, yes.
So their health might be a matter of public interest?
Could be.
Okay. Thank you. No further questions.
Ms. Hayes.
Thank you. Good morning, Commissioners, and good morning, Dr. Powell.
Good morning, Ms. Hayes.
Yes,
we're never
formal.
That formal other than here.
We have to be here. My understanding. I just want to follow up a little bit on the previous questioning, and I don't have a line number, but you were asked about burden of proof, and it was in reference to testimony where you said you weren't persuaded by the evidence provided by the interveners, and I apologize. I didn't note down the line number that counsel was referencing, but you remember that because it was 30 seconds ago. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's about the extent of my memories.
Okay, great.
30 seconds.
So your attorney has been very clear that you are not an attorney. Is that correct?
Thank goodness, yes.
Yeah, isn't that nice? You made
I've told
better
you my joke
choice.
Before. I'll ask me later and I'll tell you my joke.
Okay, I will. So when you say that you're unpersuaded by the evidence provided by the interveners, you're not making a dispositive or legal conclusion on the issues at hand, are you?
No, I'm making that conclusion as an analyst.
All right. And would you agree that there is a difference between not providing evidence of benefits and a lack of benefits?
Yes.
So, okay. Okay, great. Then, I've crossed out a lot of questions, so if you'll permit me to sort of root through the and find the ones I'd like to ask.
Ms. Hayes, do you want a minute? We'll be off the record. And
I found it. Thank you. Can I direct you to lines 204 through 207 of your surrebuttal testimony?
Hang on. 204, did you say?
Yes.
Okay.
You say no cost-benefit study will change the fact that net metering customers are using the distribution system at the time of the distribution peak for their own needs and therefore should pay consistent with cost causation and equitable share of that service.
Correct.
Okay. And I'd like to, just before I question you, refer you back to a portion of your testimony that Mr. Coley asked you about where you recognize that SB 208 does require some form of cost-benefit analysis. But in this statement here, you make two statements as far as I can see it. You make a policy argument that customers should pay their share of the costs of a particular service consistent with cost causation. Is that correct?
Correct.
And you also make a factual assertion that cost-benefit analysis will not change the fact that net metering customers are using the distribution system at the time of the distribution peak. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What if comprehensive cost-benefit analysis does illuminate that net metering customers do reduce their distribution peak load? Should that factor into cost-benefit analysis?
Yes, but that's not what this says here. So I disagree with the premise of your question. All I said was is that they're using the system at the peak. I didn't make a statement here that they weren't reducing their peak.
But a reduction in peak load could, you did say that that should factor into cost-benefit analysis. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. If cost-benefit analysis shows the net metering customers reduce system peak load, should they receive the offsetting value of those benefits?
Receive those in what way?
Well, if, for example, a reduction in system peak load as contributed to by net metering customers lowers costs allocated to Utah or costs allocated to the residential class, should that be recognized in cost-benefit analysis?
Yes, but I think that's already recognized in the cost of service study that the company files with the... Because we use a system of dynamic allocation factors in the cost of service study. And so if there's any reduction in the class's contribution to these peaks that were talked about yesterday, then those benefits are automatically allocated to those classes. The same would be true for the system peak and interjurisdictional allocations.
But the company didn't actually look at net metering customers specifically in its cost of service study, did it?
Yes, they did. I mean, they are part of the cost of service study.
Right, but as customers for sure, but not specifically at the impacts of net metering customers apart from their reduced consumption as evidenced in the exhibit of Ms. Stewart.
Could you rephrase that for me, please?
I
think I'm going to agree with you, but okay. I want you to rephrase it.
Okay. So in the company's cost of service study, they did not distinguish specifically impacts associated with net metering customers among all residential customers. Is that correct?
I think that's correct.
All right. All right. If you'll excuse me one moment. All right. In your I'm trying to find. I feel like I've written down the wrong line number. Oh, let's see. Surrebuttal testimony at line 41. Let's see. Or perhaps, yeah, so at 48, rather, you say, given the fact that we have a net metering program in place with an existing tariff, I'm skipping. The commission would be forced to immediately suspend the net metering tariff if the commission were to follow intervener's argument to its logical conclusion. I don't know why I just jumbled the order of that sentence. I apologize, but did I?
It's a fair characterization of what it says.
Thank you. As a utility regulator, are you familiar with what happens when the company files changes to a tariff or proposes changes to its programs or services?
Yes.
Does the commission send you an action request and you
everything that is filed with the commission, yes,
absolutely.
We get an action request.
We appreciate that.
I don't. I didn't say that on the record.
Strike that. What happens if the commission or the division or the office or another interested party wants to investigate a proposed change more thoroughly?
It, So the question is, if the company files for some change and we want to take more time and investigate that, what happens?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when the company files, let's keep it as a simple or a fairly, at least not a rate case,
yeah.
A fairly simple tariff change. Maybe there's some language change to the tariff that they're proposing. They would file that with the commission. The commission would issue us an action request. If we wanted to take, and my understanding of the law, okay, is that the commission has 30 days under those circumstances, once again, to act. If they don't act within the 30 days, then whatever the company's proposing automatically goes into effect. So if we want more time, we would send a memo back to the commission in response to the action request and request more time to study that. The commission, if they agree with us, then the commission would suspend the tariff, or at least the proposed tariff, so it would not go into effect. And then we would do whatever we're going to do and file a final memo sometime later.
So the commission would suspend the proposed changes, not the existing tariff. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I think that's all my questions for you.
But I would like to explain what I meant here and the reason I said it.
Sure.
Some of the intervening parties have argued that a very strict interpretation of what I see as SB 208, that this comprehensive cost benefit analysis has to be performed before the commission can enact a new tariff. What I was pointing out here in my testimony is that's a favorable editing of what the statute says. The statute says, and this is on line 39 of my surrebuttal testimony, it says, including new or existing tariffs. And that's what I'm pointing out, is if you follow the logic that the interveners have said, the commission can't impose this net metering charge without doing that comprehensive net cost-benefit analysis, then by extension, they have to suspend the existing tariff. We have a tariff in place. When the commission issues an order on this docket, and by that I mean the entire order, revenue requirement and all of the other cost of service and rate design issues, they will be implementing a net metering tariff. That net metering tariff will have new charges in it, or new credits, because we are increasing the energy rates at which those net metering customers are compensated. So if that's the interpretation that the interveners want to give to the statute, then it seems obvious to me that they would have to suspend that tariff, those new rates.
And although I said I didn't have questions for you, just
and that's not a I'm not legally interpreting it.
My question was this is
I'm just saying let's accept the logic or the argument that those interveners have. So
do you accept
maybe it is a legal interpretation, but it's no more legal interpretation than what the other interveners witnesses have.
All right.
Done.
You are not an attorney, so and you're not making a legal conclusion, and I suppose further that you are not basing your conclusion on, for example, considerations, legal considerations about burden of proof that you've been questioned about earlier as well. Is that correct?
I'm not basing it on legal interpretations of burden of proof, no.
Do you concede that there could be other logical conclusions?
Logical conclusions to what?
Well, you're to this statutory interpretation, if you'll pardon the legal phrase.
I believe that another person could look at this and try to make an argument that there's another logical conclusion to reach.
All right.
Thanks very much. Unless you have more to add, I'm finished with you.
There were other questions asked yesterday that I wish people would ask me.
Oh, I'm sorry to disappoint you.
Your Honor, I apologize. Given the questioning that occurred, can you, the commission indulge me in asking a few cross questions?
I would just like to object to the extent that the commission generally doesn't allow friendly cross-examination and doesn't allow agreeing parties to rehabilitate each other's witnesses.
And this is not that, Your Honor. It was just in response to the burden of proof issue. And I believe that you have extended the courtesy to Mr. Rossetti and yesterday. So
we have, although Ms. Hayes' point about rehabilitation is appropriate. So what do you intend to ask, Ms. Hayes?
I just have four questions, Your Honor, about burden of proof.
About Dr. Powell's view of the burden in this case, because I think we've been over that pretty significantly.
No, Your Honor, just about the phase of the case that we're in and how that relates to the TASS cross-exhibit that was admitted into evidence earlier, which was asked of Mr. Powell, and so it just relates to that.
Pardon me, Commissioner. I don't believe the task exhibit has been admitted to evidence at this point, and given Mr. Powell's answer, it does not need to be.
I may have the same objections to these questions as well as I did earlier, depending on
what they are. In light of the fact that the exhibit's not going to be offered, I'm going to turn to Mr. Jetter and see if he has redirect for the witness, Ms. Ogle. Thank you.
And I have no redirect.
Commissioner LeVar.
In this docket, we have costs presented to us that relate to distribution and customer service costs. Rocky Mountain Power has indicated that at a later time they're engaging in a load study that will evaluate, including other things, transmission and generation costs. So considering that this docket is focusing on distribution and customer service costs, should our comparison of benefits also focus only on benefits that relate directly to distribution and customer service?
No, not necessarily. I think it's up to the commission to decide if they want to go forward with another docket, what the scope of that docket would be. I'm assuming, maybe incorrectly, that there would be some input from parties on what that scope might be, and the division would have several things that it would articulate that should be included also in the scope of that docket. So I think the final decision, again, is up to the commission.
Okay. In this docket, though,
okay.
Do you think that we should compare benefits that relate to transmission and generation to costs in this docket that relate to distribution and customer service?
No, I don't think it's absolutely necessary to do it that way. And again, it goes back to, I think, what the division's position is this is about recovery of those distribution costs. And I would argue that if there are uncaptured benefits, and I tried to state this in my testimony, if there are uncaptured benefits, then those should be applied on the compensation side. In other words, what are we compensating net metering customers at? We're compensating them at the full retail rate at the moment. If we try to say that there's a group of benefits over here somewhere that are not being captured and we're going to apply those and reduce the net metering charge or do away with it, those distribution costs don't go away. They're still there. And if we do it that way, then we're distorting the volumetric prices for everybody. In other words, we're relying on those volumetric prices to send a proper price signal to customers, hopefully so that they will conserve. That's part of the reason for the tiered rates. But if we just start, in some sense, arbitrarily increasing those volumetric rates because we're not recovering a group of costs over here that are related to the distribution, that's not going to lead to efficiencies. We might get conservation, but it's not an efficient use of resources. We have to set rates at least partially on marginal costs. And it would be only coincidental that that type of a scenario would lead to setting volumetric costs, or prices, excuse me, at the marginal cost of the company. Does that answer your question?
I think so.
Okay.
I have a couple other questions before I turn it over. As I look at your testimony, it seems you have not taken a position on the Office of Consumer Services proposal to tier the fee based on installed capacity. It also seems to me the office's proposal is based on the starting point of the company's proposed 465 rather than your proposed 425. Do you have anything else you'd like to add on that issue?
First off, yeah, we recommend that the commission adopt the 425. If the commission is inclined to adopt the office's alternative calculation and net metering charge, then we would recommend that that be based on the 425. And the division would not oppose that type of a charge.
And my last question is, what would you see as the cost causation implications of, rather than imposing a fee, reducing the net metering credits to a percentage of retail that would come to the same revenue?
And that's an intriguing idea, and it is one of the things that or at least a general review of the net metering tariff, the division would recommend be part of any comprehensive cost-benefit analysis. And I certainly think that that's an alternative that's worth considering. So if I understand the premise behind your question, what you're saying is that there are distribution, transmission, and generation fixed costs, and O&M costs that all go into those volumetric rates. If distribution costs are, as an arbitrary number, 30% of that bucket of costs, then would a viable alternative be to set net metering credit value at 30% of that bucket of costs? And I think that's a legitimate question to ask and explore here. Okay? You bet.
Morning, Dr. Powell.
Good morning.
Yesterday, you may have heard me ask Mr. Gimbel a couple of questions about the public comments that we're receiving and the notion that some sort of net metering fee or cost recovery, should we decide to apply that in the case of the public comments, is somehow going to be a great detriment to solar enrollments. And it looks like, at least according to Mr. Gimbel, and do you agree that there's no information in this particular docket that deals with any elasticity of demand studies or approaches that question?
I agree that there, I haven't seen or remember anybody talking about the elasticity of demand in that concept, but I did read a couple of emails early on in this docket that articulated that particular idea that somehow the net metering charge would discourage customers from enrolling or adopting rooftop solar. The one email that I remember off the top of my head, the numbers are vague, but I remember the customer saying something about $1,500 or maybe $2,000 over the life of the PV panels. I never could figure out where that customer was coming up with that $1,500 or the $2,000. There wasn't enough detail in the email to say that. So I did my own calculations based on the company's original proposed $4.25. So $4.25 a month for 25 years is approximately $1,275. Now, the mistake I think that the person made in the email was they were assuming that they would have to pay that charge up front. And I would agree that if they had to pay that up front, that that might be a detriment to enrolling. But they're actually going to pay that over a number of years, the 25 years, or the life of the solar project. And so if you look at it from that perspective, you really should look at it on a net present value basis. So again, at $4.25 a month, you're spending approximately $1,275 over the 25 years. Using the company's approximate cost of capital, weighted cost of capital, that would be about $58.62 on a present value basis. And so at, I think there was yesterday, I think you mentioned in your questioning of Mr. Gimbel, $10,000, $15,000, or $20,000 system. At a $10,000 system, that would equate to 0.59%. So that $58 is a very small upfront cost, at least in equivalent value. It's a very small upfront cost relative to the cost of the system. At $20,000, of course, it's about half of that, about 0.3%, excuse me. So no, I don't think that the net metering charge is going to have any substantial impact on people's willingness to adopt rooftop solar.
Thank you.
I don't have any questions, Mr. Jeter. Any follow-up?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Powell. You're excused.
Thank you.
The division would like to call the second witness, Stan Frenyers.
Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Mr. Frenyers, would you please state your name and occupation for the record? I think, can you hold on just, I think your microphone might be turned off.
My name is Stan Frenyers. I'm a managing consultant with LaCapra Associates.
Thank you. And were you a consultant for the division on this rate case?
I was.
And have you filed direct and rebuttal testimony in this docket?
I have.
And if I were to ask you the same questions that are contained in your both direct and rebuttal testimony today, would your answers remain the same?
They would.
With that, I'd like to move to enter those. I believe the direct has already been taken by the commission and enter the rebuttal testimony and the exhibits.
Objections? They're received.
Have you prepared a brief statement that summarizes your testimony?
I have.
Please go ahead. Thank you.
I presented direct and rebuttal testimony on behalf of the Division of Public Utilities on May 22nd and June 26th, respectively. In my direct testimony, I addressed the subject of the company's proposed net metering facilities charge and related policy issues. I concluded that at the time that the net metering charge should be reviewed carefully within the context of a benefit cost analysis to the extent practicable in this rate proceeding, as directed in recent Utah legislation, Senate Bill 208. I noted the company had not provided such a benefit cost analysis at that time. Together with division witness Dr. Artie Powell, I noted that the division has reviewed the net metering charge originally proposed by the company of $4.25 per month and found that it was within a zone of reasonableness and acceptably balanced costs and benefits until a more comprehensive study could be undertaken. Without such a charge, net metering customers do not contribute fully towards especially distribution system as well as potentially other fixed costs. This leads to a cross-subsidy from non-net metered to net metered customers, violating the rate-making principle that rates reflect cost causation. Further, it's inequitable and economically inefficient. In my rebuttal testimony, I commented on the sufficiency of the record in this proceeding concerning the costs and benefits of the Rocky Mountain Power Net Energy Metering Program, concluding that RMP failed to provide at that time a full cost-benefit analysis of its net metering program of the type required by SB 208. Likewise, other intervening parties have not provided an adequate cost-benefit analysis. I reiterated the division does not oppose the suggestion by a number of parties that further inquiry occur either under the current docket or in a separate proceeding. I also addressed in rebuttal certain statements regarding net metering made in the testimony of Messrs. Gilliam and Mulvaney on behalf of Utah Clean Energy and the Sierra Club, respectively. I found that the cost-benefit analyses discussed in Mr. Gilliam and Mr. Mulvaney's direct testimonies did not make a conclusive case that the benefits of net metering clearly outweighed the costs for net residential customers. And I rejected the notion that power exported to the grid from net metering customers does not result in a loss of cost recovery to the company. As I point out in testimony, Rocky Mountain Power may not be currently recovering the full fixed costs of the distribution system from residential net metering customers. I did not address every potential issue and reiterate that silence on any particular issue does not necessarily signal agreement. Agreement, yes.
Mr. Frenyers is available for cross-examination.
Thank you. Ms. Hogle or Mr. Moskin?
No questions.
The office has no questions for Mr. Frenyers. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Rossetti.
Thank you. And good morning, Mr. Frenyers.
Good morning.
I have to admit, the first time I read zone of reasonableness, the phrase cone of silence came to mind. Would you mind just defining that term, please?
Hopefully I'll do better than Maxwell Smart.
Yes.
Well, obviously it's not a highly quantitative phrase. I was attempting to suggest that there was reasonable amount of evidence adduced to suggest that net metering customers were not contributing fully to fixed cost recovery of especially the distribution system. The company's proposed charge attempted to correct for that and to result in some contribution towards distribution and retail costs. On the one hand, the size of that charge at $425 per month did make some contribution towards those fixed costs from the population of net metering customers. And on the other hand, it was not so, did not appear so potentially burdensome so as to seriously affect the program, its success going forward.
Okay. So that term hasn't been codified anywhere. It's just a kind of an opinion.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks. The department, I think is the right term.
Division.
Thank you. The division has suggested 4.25 versus 465. Would you mind telling me what the difference is between the two proposals and why you'd be happy with 4.25?
Well, 40 cents is the answer to your first question, not to be flip. it has to do with the principle of gradualism. The 465 was developed after revenue requirements were agreed to in this proceeding, was obviously being a higher charge, starts to push the impact of that potentially new charge up on the program, and given the division's reliance on the principle of gradualism, we feel that 425 is still an acceptable contribution by net metered customers.
Okay. Have you done any estimate as to what the full recovery charge would be if you were to recover the full cost of service not collected?
Other than review of the company's analysis on that, I did not perform any particular analysis that suggests that the number should be higher.
Okay. Other than the conclusion that we can come to that it does not fully recover the charges at this time, if it were to be accepted at 4.25?
Yes.
Yes. Sorry for phrasing my question badly.
Can I jump in really quick and ask Mr. Frenders, can you pull the microphone just a little bit around? Because I think the court reporter is having a little bit of difficulty at times.
I apologize.
Here. Thank you.
You put together some scenarios in your rebuttal on starting on page 6, which you used to counter-argue with Mr. Gilliam's testimony. You put together 3 scenarios. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Did you happen to do a scenario that compares a conserving and high efficiency customer using the same conclusions or assumptions, using the same assumptions?
No separate scenario was prepared other than potentially that a conserving customer could be represented in any one of my 3 scenarios.
But they're not taking into account the investment in the conservation or efficiency measures taken by the customer?
In my scenario analysis, no.
Okay, thank you. I will sacrifice my questions to the next person. Thank you very much for your answers.
You're welcome.
Mr. Plank? Thank you, Commissioner Clark. Good morning, Mr. Frenders. My name is Bruce Plank. I'm one of the attorneys representing the Alliance for Solar Choice. Good morning.
Good morning, Counselor.
Let me ask you a couple of questions to follow up on Dr. Powell's testimony. Were you here a few minutes ago when Dr. Powell was asked and answered questions about the burden of proof in utility cases?
I was here.
And you heard him answer the question that basically the utility company has the burden of going forth and the burden of proof as to any new rates or charges that they propose, correct?
I'm not sure that Dr. Powell made that statement in particular. There was some discussion and some objection as to whether he could make a statement that rendered a legal opinion, given that he was not a lawyer.
Well, let me just ask you directly. Do you agree that as a general matter of utility rate making, the utility company proposing a new tariff or charge has the burden of proof of going forward?
Yes.
And that burden of proof cannot be passed on to other parties in the case. Do you agree with that?
I'm going to object on the same grounds as earlier with Dr. Powell, that these are legal questions that are outside the scope of his direct testimony.
Well, Commissioner Clark, if I understood Mr. Frenier's summary, and my notes may not have been accurate, but my notes said that he said that he felt that Mr. Gilliam and Mr. Mulvaney did not make the case against Rocky Mountain Power's proposed charge. And I think I'm entitled to follow up on that statement. If he believes they have some case to be made, you know, the position that TASC has taken, and I believe it's been quite clear in the other testimony, is that that's not an issue that is required by TASC or any of the other interveners. That's strictly a matter for Rocky Mountain Power to put forth. And they don't, nobody else, whether it be our clients or anyone else other than the company, has to make a case. And I think I'm entitled to ask them about that.
I disagree. I think that whether or not the other witnesses were persuasive to the division is irrelevant to the question of the legal burden of proof that's upon the parties in this case. And the other witnesses' testimony is not Mr. Frenier's direct testimony. And so because other witnesses have testified about certain things does not expand the scope of Mr. Frenier's direct testimony.
Mr. Plank, perhaps if you ask the witness about his statement about the case to be made and his reason for using that language,
okay,
you can make your general points.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner Clark.
His views of what the burden of proof is in the proceeding will not be, a focus of the commission's
sure
order.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you, Commissioner Clark. Okay, Mr. Frenier's, let's deal with that. Your testimony was that, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the parties you mentioned didn't convince you of their positions. Is that what you were saying? Didn't convince you of what they were saying?
On the points I raised in rebuttal, yes.
Have you had a chance to study net metering charges in other jurisdictions?
This is a relatively new frontier. I'm aware of some of the policy that is starting to be made in other jurisdictions, but I am not an expert on other jurisdictions' net energy metering charges.
Mr. Gimbel testified yesterday, and I know you weren't here, that there was one state, Arizona, which had enacted a net metering charge recently. Are you aware of any other states that have a net metering charge of any sort?
No, I'm not.
Did I understand your testimony correctly to say that you recommended that a new docket be established to fully explore net metering costs and benefits to comply with Senate Bill 208?
To the extent that the record in this docket would be incomplete and or given the prerogatives of the commission, the division did not oppose that concept of a separate docket.
So would it be fair to say that your position is that a fuller cost-benefit analysis of the net metering program would be required to comply with Senate Bill 208?
That is a determination for the commission to make. In terms of the standards relating to costs and benefits, whether the evidence in this proceeding is sufficient. So I would accept whatever the commission determined to be the standard and whether the evidence in this proceeding was sufficient to address that standard.
Well, are there costs or benefits of the Rocky Mountain Power net metering program in Utah that you believe were not explored in the testimony that's been provided?
Yes.
And those are the kind of items that could be more fully explored with a fuller cost-benefit analysis being undertaken in the future, correct?
Yes.
And your suggestion was that the format of a new docket might be an appropriate venue to do that, correct?
Correct.
You answered a few questions from Mr. Rossetti a few minutes ago about the chart that you have in your rebuttal testimony, right?
I did.
And do you accept the general principle of cost causation for the allocation of fixed costs?
I do.
And wouldn't you agree that avoided variable costs are generally higher during hours of solar production?
Well, it's dependent upon the time of day and dependent upon the season, but they could be, yes.
And would you not agree it would be important to consider coincident peak demand on individual circuits before you could make an informed cost allocation of distributed assets?
Could you restate that, please?
Sure. You would need to look at coincident peak demand on different individual circuits before you could come to a complete cost allocation, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And so if it turned out that net metering customers in the Rocky Mountain Power service territory are generating power during peak periods, they should be allocated a significantly smaller share of distribution-related costs. Is that correct?
Again, it depends on whether those facilities are operational, the extent to which their production output does, in fact, reduce the coincident peak on the distribution circuits, and whether that's happening on all distribution circuits or majority of them versus here and there.
And in your review of the testimony the company provided in this case, is the data available to be able to come to a conclusion on that topic?
The company, as I understand it, presented evidence on a limited study covering one distribution circuit. So as a practical matter, yes, I'd like to see more evidence than that.
You mentioned in your rebuttal testimony that charges to net metering customers are likely to, I think the phrase you used was, erode incentives for potential purchases of solar. Is that correct?
Could you point me to that testimony? I don't recall that.
I believe it's on line 208, but let me find it. Uh, 209 and 210. Of your rebuttal testimony?
I indicated there may well be an eroded incentive. I did not offer an opinion as to the extent of that erosion, and I was putting it in the context of comparing the charge for net metering facilities to that for customer charges generally.
But is your point that additional charges to solar customers may decrease the number of new solar installations?
It's unclear whether that would happen or not. And it would depend on the size of the charges and how they compared to the investment decision the customer was making and how much the customer was investing.
Are you familiar with an annual document called Freeing the Grid? It's a state-by-state analysis of net metering policies in the different states around the country.
I'm familiar that it exists, but not. I don't have any strong study of it to be able to cite from it or to discuss it.
Well, let me ask this question and see if you can answer it. In that study, I think with the general familiarity you mentioned, the states are graded on their net metering policy, correct?
That's my recollection, subject to check.
Sure, subject to check. And if a state, and again, subject to check, Utah has an A grade at the moment on their net metering policy. Again, subject to check. Do you agree with that?
I'd That's the only other way I can agree with it is to check it.
Okay.
But and I'll take your opinion at this point.
Okay.
For your.
And would you agree that as a general proposition, fees that decrease the value that net meter customers receive might result in a decreased grade on that kind of grading system that they use?
That's hard to say. I'm too unfamiliar with the grading system, and there are a lot of other factors that might affect a grade.
Okay. The
Mr. Plank, is it a good time for a recess from
That'd be
your
great.
Perspective?
I've just got a couple more, but let me take a look, and I may be done. So let's take it. If this is a good time, Commissioner Clark, that'd be great.
Thank you. We're just a couple of minutes past the typical, so we'll be in recess until, what do you think, 20 till 25? Until 20 minutes to the hour. Thank you very much.